I'm so excited and really full of joy that I'm able to introduce today Dr. Kurt Johnson to the Conscious Evolution Summit. And Kurt, you are a professional evolutionary biologist. You are a comparative religionist. You are co-author of the book, The Coming into Spiritual Age. Also, you wrote two award-winning books, science books, and you are a host at Unity Earth. How is it called? Unity Earth.
Oh, Voice America Convergence.
Yes,
and then
yes.
Two magazines. Yeah.
And the Light on the Light magazine, and you are really active in so many networks and groups and organizations. And so I'm really looking forward to have this conversation with you, especially I'm really especially interested in this, the coming into spiritual age. And you bring such an interesting combination of being a scientist and also study different religions. So I'm so looking forward to hear from you, your perspective on the situation we are right now in as humanity in a big transition. We are all participating if we want or not. So, share maybe your, what started you to be interested in this different,
This very broad landscape.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're all creatures of just how we grow up and circumstances. And for me, what was always very odd was that I was always very good at everything and I was always very interested in everything. So even by the time I got to university, I really couldn't pick between literature or music or science or philosophy. And so because I was a great multitasker, I actually ended up doing a lot of those. So I have like 5 different academic degrees across those areas. And then also got to know so many people who were leaders in those areas as I was coming up in my track in the 60s and 70s. Well, the point being that there was a time early on where that broad mix of things didn't necessarily make sense. Now, as time has gone along and we've moved into the integral or holistic era, whatever we call it, as of the 70s, 80s, 90s, then it really started to make sense to really have expertise and also a track record academically in all of those fields. And that then being in New York and being associated with the United Nations. And then I was 30 years at the American Museum of Natural History, and I've been 25 years at the New York Interfaith Seminary, and then, of course, out on the event and conference circuit where you meet so many people, then suddenly it started to be a set of skill sets that really could serve in a big way. So even at the UN now, since I'm, you know, technically retired and take on all that work in retirement, all the committees that I'm on, again, are in this very broad swath across culture and sustainability and ecology and climate change. And so I've been a part of the spirituality and sustainability conferences at the Vatican and the whole outsourcing of the Laudato Si message. And then one of the co-founders of, you know, this whole broad thing called the interspiritual movement, which goes back to Wayne Teasdale and Bede Griffiths, Father Thomas Keating. So all of those people, Raymond Panikkar, that I was lucky, you know, to know personally and then also be very intimately associated with, you know, both Wayne Teasdale and then Thomas Keating. When this global discussion was just in its infancy, and what's taken for granted today, see, what's the good news now is a lot of this is old news. But there was a time 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, where the understanding of why it was so important that the religions, you know, move from the interfaith dialogue and other things to a deeper dropping from the head to the heart and going into this deeper place. You and I were talking earlier about Ramana Maharshi and Indian spiritual traditions, where this understanding of the unity of everything is just so, so profound. It's very interesting that now so many people get this, but many of us that were involved in this early on, if you look at, for instance, Father Keating's Snowmass Interreligious Dialogue, which went on for 30 years and resulted in the book The Common Heart and the 9 points of agreement among the world's religions, which Wayne Teasdale then made into the 9 elements of universal spirituality. This was just when these statements about this underlying unity were starting to be made. What I think a lot of people know was called the foundational conversation or the foundationalist conversation, which kicked into gear really after Vatican II. And we can just start discussing. There's so many angles here, but Vatican II opened the door, at least in the West, to that global discussion. And the foundational discussion then was really about what are the common grounds of the whole human spiritual experience. And of course, what it is, as we know from the contemplative experience and the contemplative traditions, it's the understanding of profound interconnection and profound unity, that nothing is separate, everything is a network of interconnection. And then the last thing I'll say, just an introduction, is that this is where science has gone. See, the other parallel track then with the new physics, and of course Bede Griffiths was involved with that from the very beginning. So the new physics, and then the understanding of the quantum field and the understanding of the holographic universe, and now the big sea change in my own specialty area where I have my PhD in evolution is the sea change in evolutionary biology from the competition view of natural selection to the cooperation view of natural selection. And that's only swept in since 2015. And actually, I'll be going to visit the Dalai Lama in late October with the founder of that paradigm in science, David Sloan Wilson from State University of New York and University of Oslo, to talk with him about the significance of this sea change that evolution selects in complex systems. It selects cooperation. It doesn't select competition. And that is a complete revolution and sea change in science. So point being, long answer to your first question, is that this has been a convergence that's gone on globally and been a convergence in my own life, and also many, many people who are out there. I could name names from, you know, Ken Wilber to Dwayne Elgin to Jude Kuravan, go through the whole list. They're all creatures of this convergence of all of these different ways of knowing, coming to this commonality of knowing, you know, what it means that everything is this interconnected network.
Mm-hmm. And Kurt, would you say that coming to this realization is kind of a natural evolution in a human being, or is there anything we could kind of support in society that more people would come to this realization?
Yeah, I think people are getting clues in different ways. And in that sense, like if you look back at your own past, or I look back at my own past, it was studies that you did, books that you read, people that you met, understanding that the world was having the same conversation. So the path of the conversation was very similar for the world as it was actually in individuals in the world. So you were walking that path, I was walking that path. Go through all the lists, we'll say, of people that we associate a lot with in the, you know, the conference scene or events or the, you know, the media about unity consciousness and all this. All of these people were on this track. But obviously the really deepest part is the contemplative and unity consciousness experience of the individual consciousness. You know, without that, it's only an idea. In other words, like many people have said, even a good quantum physicist can understand these profound interrelationships intellectually. But to have those drop into consciousness, into the resonant field, particularly the resonant field of the heart, and the understanding of that connection, again, back when we were talking at the beginning about Ramana Maharshi, where you meet this intersection of the whole realm of the heart, you know, the subtle realms, the emotions, love, go through the whole list. And then when this intersects with our knowledge about, I mean, it's like Ken Wilber says, there's knowledge of, and then there's knowledge about. So there's a deep first person experience of this knowledge, and then there are second and third person knowledges of it. That's our knowledge is about. And both are valid. So I think, you know, to go back to your question, what's going back on in the world now is the proliferation of this narrative. And that narrative is, again, happening in all of those sectors. It's happening in the personal narratives of spiritual people who are discussing the consciousness experience and the unity consciousness experience. And then that would be what, you know, what Ken Wilber would call quadrant one, or that, you know, that the personal, there's the first person experience. But in second and third person, then you have all the narratives of, you know, how the universe is put together, how the quantum field operates, how the subtle realms operate. And we even now have a convergence between the understandings of shamanism, how a shaman looks at nature and how a scientist looks at nature. And those are a yin and a yang, and a right hand and a left hand. And so the good news that's exciting now is that the world is full of this yin and yang, left hand and right hand understanding of the different aspects of all of this. And that's rich and exciting, and it's fulfilling, and it's good to see in a species that's as imperiled as we are, and we are vastly imperiled, that arising still in that primate, in this crazy, crazy species, Homo sapiens, is this deeper person. And that's where we see the crazy paradox of the embedded history of our bonobo and chimp and primate behavior, which is all about this, and then the arising deeper consciousness, which is about this, and the question of whether one can actually replace, transcend, and include the other in our evolutionary track. Otherwise, we will probably extinguish ourselves through greed is good, climate change, war, go through the list. And that, even if you're an atheist, even when I talk to my scientific colleagues who don't have a spiritual background, they just see it as an anthropological question. Can this particular primate get out of tribe and clan and into a global civilization that has a profound sense of interconnection such that everything is welcome? And you know very well from, again, going back to Ramana Maharshi, what is the message? Everything is welcome. Mm-hmm. And that's very different than the world of Donald Trump or the world of so much of the world that's at war with itself.
Yeah, thank you so much for these really beautiful explanations. And I just wonder, I mean, all what we are kind of experiencing now, it seems that we seem to be under a bit time pressure with all of that. And I mean, as you said, this movement is really growing, but really also a majority of humans isn't in this understanding right now. So in your perspective, is there anything what we who are kind of had this really one person inner experiences and we really we can talk from it and we have this experience could do to support to even help others to lift up into that realization?
Yeah, well, as some people say, and it's said a lot, you know, we have to do it all. This conversation, everything that's going on is happening, and I know Wilber calls it, of course, the four quadrants, which are really just the first, second, and third person experience of reality. It's the basis of all languages. We have the first person experience of I, we have the second person experience of we, and we have a more distant, abstract third person experience of detached ideas and things that are objectified. And all of these conversations are going on simultaneously. And so what's happening now, if you look at this in the sense of evolutionary process, every time there's been a sea change in evolution, generally for the planet, within any species and our own species, there are always bottlenecks. It's actually the term that's used. There are always bottlenecks where you have to go through in order to get to the next level. And those bottlenecks, they can either be biological relative to the environment, or they can even be cultural relative to worldviews and cultural systems. Is that what happens is the old ideas no longer work. And then you have to go through a realization that, you know, I'm not now fit for my environment. I'm not adaptable in what the environment has become. And you create a crisis situation where you're forced through some type of a major change. Now, even let's say in Homo sapiens evolution, 70,000 years ago, there were three of us, Neanderthal and Florensis and Homo sapiens. So there were actually three intelligent species on the planet. We went through a bottleneck due to supervolcano activity about 70,000 years ago, where only one of those species survived. So they actually call us now the last man standing. And the big question in any of those bottlenecks is whether it's extinction or moving into what science calls a new adaptive zone. Now, again, go back to our Ramana Maharshi discussion. If you look at your life before awakened consciousness and your life in awakened consciousness, then you understand what's meant by that new adaptive zone. When you moved into the whole world of awakened consciousness, all the skill sets of your own life, all the skill sets of your life with other people, that is a whole new landscape of dialogue and reciprocity and go through the whole list. So we're going through maybe the big one now at the global level. You know, can we have a global civilization and where all cultures, colors, backgrounds, stories are welcome? Or are we going to insist on doing this so that we would maybe drive ourselves to extinction by conflict and war simultaneously then with having polluted our home, you know, now to the point where, you know, as a result of all that pollution, then the climate change kicked in, changing even the underlying situation of the planet. I mean, I remember as a scientist, if you went from the 60s, 70s, 80s, you started out with a biodiversity crisis, which then became global warming, but then it became climate change. And the reason that those terms changed was the problem got bigger and the implications got bigger. And you first started thinking this is someone else's problem. When it was the biodiversity crisis, it was other species' problems. Then it suddenly realized, wow, this is also our problem. So then there was another term for that. So if you add that then to the other big one, which I think is, you just call greed is good. In other words, the idea of social Darwinism, the big misunderstanding of Darwin's message, which turned out to be survival of the fittest means the Shark Tank environment and social Darwinism. Well, in the first chapter of David Sloan Wilson's new book, and David Sloan Wilson, along with E.O. Wilson and Harvard and others, are the big champions of this understanding that because of group selection, what's called technically group selection, and multi-level selection in nature, nature in any complex system selects for cooperation, not for competition. So the other thing that's going on then now, so science figures this out, 2019, but is that going to change business? Is that going to change politics? Is that going to change economics? That are all on the social Darwinism model. So one of, like I said, so David Sloan Wilson's first chapter in his new book that's subtitled Completing the Darwinian Revolution is the myth of social Darwinism. That story about this, which runs politics, business, economics, is not true. Mm. And then we have to ask the question, if we're a species on this planet and the way that we're operating has nothing to do with how the evolutionary process is operating, we're on an extinction course because we're not even in sync with evolutionary process. But last thing I'll say on that, so I'm not going on and on, but it's just that there's so much richness here, is that it's incredible that it's only in 2015, in the book that came out from Yale Templeton on group and multi-level selection that concluded about cooperation and not competition, that it took that long and 154 years of social Darwinism and everything else that's gotten out of whack before we figured out fundamentally that evolutionary process, here's the key point, is in sync with the heart. I mean, our heart tells us that there can be an amazing, wonderful potential for ourselves in this planet. Mm-hmm. And yet we were told by scientific process studies, no, process is not about this, process is about that. And the heart is swimming upstream against that. Now, the sea change now, this is amazing good news, which I think is why His Holiness invited David and I over to talk to him about this, is that once you have evolution selecting for cooperation, selecting for altruism, selecting for good behavior, selecting for the nice guys, then the wind is at the back of sacred activism and the world of the heart and game changers, world changers like yourself, and so many others that we work with. So the wind's not at our face anymore. The wind's at our back. Now, we knew that, but we didn't have science telling us that. And I'll just add one more thing to that. So David Sloan Wilson, in a recent film in which he's interviewed, they asked him, why did he stick with group selection and multi-level selection so long when it was considered heresy by most of science? Well, there's many heresies. Continental drift was considered a heresy. The bird-dinosaur relationship was considered a heresy. And they're all no-brainers now. Everybody knows that they're true. But what David said is he stuck with it, and this is so important to the spiritual message, because any other view of who we are was counterintuitive to his experience of consciousness and being. And he wasn't saying that as a spiritual person. He considers himself a humanist or an atheist. But he absolutely felt, certainly as all the great humanists did, who left out God, but they talked about human potential, that the wind is at our back and where the heart is telling us to go. So that, at least in my old age, that's good news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, while I was listening to you, Kurt, I had this question in mind, what would help us to be in sync with evolution? But you already answered this question, to be really connected with our heart and our deeper nature. And just yesterday I was in a meeting and a man shared, he is a director in a company since 17 years, four other men, they have every month a board meeting, and they would have really hard times where they were a lot in conflict and not agreeing on things. So 16, 70 years, not so beautiful board meetings. But he was participating in a year-long class with Barbara Max Hubbard, where it was about birthing a new species, and he realized a lot in himself, and he said he's so amazed that now in the board meeting, the most topic they talk about and only men is love and the heart. That was so interesting to hear.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And also, I'm so glad you reminded me, because you'd been asking that question. I hadn't directly answered it. The important thing now for everybody is to get this narrative out there. And that means through the arts, through music, through scholarly work, through inspirational writing, through speaking, through events. We have to get this worldview that's about the welcoming, that there's room for everything. That just has to get out there. So what I'm very excited about now is all the younger folk, call them millennials, post-millennials, it keeps changing all the time. My own kids have gone through all of those stages. Getting that message out in such a huge way, in the way that they understand it. Now, I'm going to say something now that I don't mean to cast any shadow or anything, but it was disturbing to me, but it's a fact of life. I was on a conference call yesterday with people who are doing this. They're getting out the message massively through social media, and in a very successful way, so that when they get something out, it gets like 6,000 likes, 7,000 likes, so they're getting it out there. But they were having this run through some metrics, and the people were telling them that right now your message is at the eighth grade level. And in order for people to understand it, you got to get it down to the fifth grade level. Now, I don't know in Germany what those translate as, but like a eighth grader would like maybe be 10 or 12 years old. A fifth grade would be 6 or 7 or 8 years old, maybe, whatever it might be. Now, that was disturbing to me, that most people in the world now can only think or absorb at the fifth grade level. that doesn't give me a lot of hope for the future of the planet. But on the other hand, then you have to say, well, if that's a fact of life in the world of social media and iPhones and all of this, then get the message out there in whatever way tells the truth. And the truth of the matter is this profound interconnection, that nothing is separate. And we're at a place in the planet now where we're either going to make that transition, or we'll be a planet that has roaches and sharks and everything else, but no longer human beings. We just may not make it. But that's the interesting time we're in.
Mm-hmm. And Kurt, as you mentioned, the younger generation, just in your perspective, what would you say is the major difference now in the younger generation relating to this topic we are talking about? I mean, it's always difficult to make generalizations, but what do you observe?
Yeah, I think on the good side, because you can't speak for everybody, but most younger people, and I even include my own two kids, who become great human beings, they get this. I mean, there's an understanding in younger people now about the interconnection of things, about the importance of love, the world of the heart, kindness, fair play, mutuality, reciprocity, go through all the lists. They get this. And they see it as a part of their fundamental understanding of reality. Now, of course, that probably means that means they've sustained the innocence of their childhood. I was just actually watching some videos last night with some friends of animals who can get along when they're basically in nature don't get along, and yet they were all younger animals, so they hadn't had conditioning yet. They were still in that innocence of loving something that usually they would eat. So I think that's the good news. The bad news, and we see this from the Trump era and the post-truth era and the counterfactual era, everything that it's called now, is the dominance of the world by what's called info entertainment. And that means when you create these narratives that are an alternate reality and they aren't true, like in the United States with 40% of people believing what is really the counterfactual reality of, let's say, the Trumpians, and yet you don't want to overlook that there are also legitimate cultural complaints that those folk have, where they've been left out and marginalized from economic growth and so one does not want to one is not demonizing them in that way. But what the message is that so much of the world now is dominated by info entertainment, and I could grab my phone here and do this, but info entertainment is usually 60-70% counterfactual. And you go on the internet now, and the type of information that's there for conspiracy theories and every imaginable thing that appeals to our kind of magic, mythic inner nature, everything that we love about superhero movies and all of that. It's about, you know, the hero within, the Joseph Campbell hero, all of that's real in us. But again, if you take that too far, and then it becomes a counterfactual narrative where there's no common reference about how you make political decisions, how you make cultural decisions, then you're back in equivalent of the Dark Ages, where there really isn't any direction to where humanity is going. So it's kind of a two-sided coin. There's good news and bad news. I'm lucky, as are you. We hang out with the inspiring people. So we're in this bubble, of wonderful people. You know?
Yeah, and what I just realized is also when I spent time with my daughters together, and I was traveling 2 years ago for 4 months, and I was also in a volunteer place in Australia in a yoga center where I was together with other 30 volunteers, and I was way older than most of them, but kind of really being for a few weeks with them together, what stood really out for me, and I mean, of course, this was also a certain kind of young people which were interested in yoga and spirituality and in traveling and combining all of that. But one thing was also that they weren't really interested in consumerizing, having a lot of stuff in matter. They are not interested in at all in that. What I need to live is enough. And they put so much emphasis in being in a good vibration together and being friends and interested in different cultures. So very different than I would have experienced it when I was in this age. Yeah. So this kind of was very interesting for me to see.
Yeah, and I think also one thing now that we about younger people is that the whole world of information is at their disposal. I remember when I was growing up in a little town in the Bible Belt in Nebraska, in the center of the United States, and you know, I didn't come east until I went to university and into seminary, and I've been out here ever since at American Museum of Natural History and New York Interfaith Seminary and now the United Nations. But back then, when we were growing up in those cultural silos, we were pretty much believed whatever cultural narrative we were told. And so, for instance, there were certain things you never heard of, life choices that you never heard of, which now are basic life choices that anyone would be aware of. But kids today, because of the internet and because of all, everything's available. Mm-hmm. Now, the good side of that is that I'm working now on the magazine issue for the United Nations Yoga Day. We do a huge issue with the UN Committee for the International Yoga Day, and this one's even bigger. Point being that it's all of these major people talking about, you know, the very thing that we're talking about. And, you know, the point now is that all of this is available. We could do a global reset based on what Wayne Teasdale called all of these wisdom resources that are available to us from science, from philosophy, from all the traditions, from the Sikhs, from the Jains, from Christianity, from Islam, from Buddhism, from all the Hindu and Vedic traditions. This is all now at our disposal. Plus, understanding, as we were talking at the beginning when we were talking about Ramana Maharshi, understanding the underlying unity of consciousness in the first place. That isn't it interesting? And most people who are watching this program, it'll even change your point of view when you ask this question. Isn't it interesting that even this is an experience in consciousness? I mean, I'm now in front of my windows. That's why my background's dark. I look bright and a little bit pale, but I'm looking out now. I can almost see all the way down to Manhattan because I'm on a hill in the Bronx here. And, you know, we just now have at our disposal this availability that we could do a global reset based on all these wisdom resources that are available. That's the gift of the time. Now, whether we will be smart enough to employ that, I think that's the other question. I mean, we're having this conversation when so many cultures, United States, Europe, and otherwise, are getting more siloed. They're getting more divided. It's getting more okay to decide that only I'm right and you're wrong, and only people who look like me are good. Very tough to know where that one is going.
And you said we could have a reset. Is it kind of, do we have influence about it or onto it, or is it just, you know, just surrender and see? So I always found myself a bit in this. I mean, I love just being inwards in myself, in this deep, deep, deep nourishment and oneness. And then, but it's also, then I get this impulse to become active, to go out, to meet. So, and maybe many people which are now watching to this this conversation have it similar. It's often a bit the stance between inner, outer, and being and doing. And I would love to hear some perspectives from you about this.
Yeah, well, this is all what we discover the older we get. It's all yin and yang. It's all left hand, right hand. It's dual essentialities. That's another thing it's called. These are essential parts of our nature. And there's a term out there now. I'm a contextual extrovert. I'm a contextual introvert. But it means that depending on the situation, I can play that. I can do that dance. So in the long run, it is a dance, and we are fundamentally anchored and wired in these two tendencies. One is a tendency toward privacy and territoriality and just that private eye space. And the other one is the tendency toward being gregarious and being dialogical and seeking reciprocity. And the choice, the truth of the matter, we don't need to choose anymore. This is what Tantra is all about, that this is always a balance of those essentialities. Now, so if we start from there and we say it's okay to be in the dance and to be over here one day and over here the other day, and that the truth of the matter is that you don't need to choose this or that, truth of the matter is you're free to choose either. Now, there's something straight out of Ramana Maharshi's tradition. The truth is that you have the choice. It's not which choice you make. And so where that goes to then goes to morphogenetic fields, in that sense that this desire to get the narrative out there that will connect to other people's heart and their activism and their movement, absolutely, we have to propel that into that larger dialogue now. So morphogenetic fields, which our friend, you know, Rupert Sheldrake has talked about, is a reality in science. In science, it's called discursive theory. And it's very simple. You write Mein Kampf, you get a certain result. You get German fascism. You write Common Cause, you get a certain result, which was the American experiment in Republican democracy. And so it means the narrative changes the behavior. And one of the great stories in academic discursive theory was when the Green discussion started in the 80s, and many of the big corporations didn't want to have the Green discussion, but political correctness meant that they had to. What happened was even having the Green discussion made them green aware, even when they didn't want to be green aware. Mm. So the discursive theory studies show that when you put that out there in the narrative, it catches on. And I think that's the hope we have to have. That, especially the story that's aligned with the heart, the one that gives you the big yes inside, the huge big yes. That's gotta be universal, you would think, for all people. And then therefore you have to believe that if you tell this story, it's gonna catch on. I mean, I will say, you know, when I'm with groups of people and around someone inspiring, let's say with Barbara, when she was still with us, so many others, to be in the room and to hear them go on their thing, go on their riff, and get out there riffing about how excited they are about potential. You know, everybody in the room just lights up. And what's interesting, a lot of people don't know, is that the stories of the magic carpet from Islam and the Sufis and Persia, that's what the story comes from. It came from people sitting around on a carpet, and they'd all get spiritually high together talking about the potential of the true nature and who we really are. And they would all just like fly into this ecstatic shared consciousness. And that actually became the magic carpet story. But that's what happens. I'm sure you've gone to certain people. Remember the first time I went to see Coleman Barks read Rumi? Oh my God. I mean, how many encores could a guy give? And he kept giving another encore and another encore, because every poem that he read, let alone his comments on the side, you were really just blissed out. And so, you know, so that's got to be a part of our nature. It is, and that we can believe in that. So anyway, hope so.
Wonderful. And I just have this idea to shift a bit to another question, because I have a biologist just in front of me, and I wonder if we would take this journey from a caterpillar to a butterfly, which is often used as a metaphor for maybe in a kind of a transition we are, What would you say, in which state are we as humanity right now?
Yeah, well, see, it's interesting. That's my specialty in science is butterflies. And I've named about 50 or 60 genera and a couple thousand species. And I'm kind of an authority, particular on South America and the population. You know, a couple of the books I've written, one that actually the laptop is sitting on here in order to get it at eye level.
I picked that up in the morphogenetic field.
I have three copies of my book, Fine Lines, here, which is about Vladimir Nabokov's work on the blue butterflies, and that he turned out to be right when so many people thought he was wrong. So, you know, I'm very familiar with this metaphor. I have to say that to me, sometimes for me as a scientist, it gets overplayed, but I'm okay with that. I have to listen to the story of the imaginal cells and the war inside the chrysalis. I hear it over and over. Everybody loves it. And it's true. For me as a scientist, it's a little bit old news. But, you know, the answer to that, this is what's interesting. The answer to your question, Ken Wilber would say, it's happening at different rates in every silo everywhere. And it's all marching through the developmental stages, but all of these are at different places in the world and in at different times, but it's all marching forward. Now, I find it interesting that the metaphor even exists. In other words, if the metaphor is so good relative to spiritual transformation and human potential, and obviously it's a great metaphor, isn't it interesting that that evolved in nature? Now, in nature, then you have to ask, well, why did it evolve? The answer is simple. It's a strategy. Every species on Earth, or every group of species, it has a strategy. So the strategy of insects was, we're going to be different people at different times. We're going to be able to hold like three radically different jobs. What we do as the egg, the caterpillar, the larva, you know, and then the chrysalis and the butterflies, you actually four jobs. So it would be like you had four jobs and nobody knew it. You had four lives that nobody knew about. And the point is that every one of those lives is in a different part of the ecosystem. So the strategy for survival is different in every case. So it's like being a chameleon. First you're living this way, then you're living this way. First you're crawling, then you're flying. I mean, that's bizarre. But the conditions are a great survival strategy because every one of those situations is different relative to, predators and the dangers that are out there against you. So actually, all of these things evolved as a strategy, and the insect world decided, well, metamorphosis is a great strategy. First, we're going to be this, then we're going to be this, then we're going to be this, and it works. So what happens then is that nature then chooses by what survives what strategies work. And that strategy worked in a big way. And for instance, now in ecology, there are two kinds of basic life strategies. It's called R and K. Because it has to do with a geometrical distribution, statistical distribution, which is a sine wave, bell curve up, bell curve down. And so the one example is fish and insects, and where you have tons of offspring and maybe like 0.01% survives. But you do nothing to nurture them. You just spew them out there and maybe 1 out of 1,000 makes it. Well, if you have 1,000 offspring and 1 out of 1,000 make it, pretty good strategy. Now, the other strategy, which the mammals have used, and with us, it's incredible. Like, talk to your single parent friends and they say, when can we get together? And your single parent friend says, well, contact me in 20 years. Yeah. We spend all of that time, 9 months in the womb, up to 20 years nurturing one or two offspring, elephants the same way, all the big mammals, whales same way, where we put all of this emphasis into nurturing, and that's the strategy for survival. So, it's interesting. Maybe there's a deeper lesson there, not only in the fight of the imaginal cells, which first are attacked by the immune system in the chrysalis, that says, no, we want to be a caterpillar. We don't want to be a butterfly. And they have this battle, and then one gradually wins over the other, and the butterfly emerges and off it flies. And it's a fantastic metaphor. Maybe there's something in that even deeper about the potential of our global holistic knowledge. I mean, it's again, another book that's in my pile here is The Religion of Tomorrow by Ken Wilber, that thick, which is helping me hold the laptop up here at eye level. And, you know, this is exactly what he's saying, is that we're at this time of harvest. It's very interesting. A lot of people may not know that Ken Wilber's saying, like, waking up, the understanding of this in consciousness has been around for a few thousand years. Anytime any person woke up anywhere from the Buddha onward, waking up has been there. But growing up, and then growing up, cleaning up, showing up, linking up, and lifting up, all of the ups that we talk about now, the book that we did for the Parliament of the World Religions is waking up, growing up, cleaning up, showing up, linking up, and lifting up. And I think everybody gets that. But like Ken Wilber says, growing up, in other words, building the world that reflects the world we're talking about internally, has really only been possible, let's say, in the last 150 years. The Industrial Revolution, the knowledge we have of science and technology, the holistic knowledge that we have of all the cultures in the world, Ken Wilber says, and I think he's absolutely right, this is a time where we could put the two together. We could link the waking up with the growing up. So it may well be that we're at that period of emergence of the butterfly based on this set of global resources that we have, you know, from the vast knowledge that we have now, from science, philosophy, technology, the great wisdom traditions, and on and on and on. Mm-hmm.
And Kurt, we are almost at the end of our time together. It's really so fast. But I would also be interested, what value do you see in really coming together in networks? You are also active in so many networks. What is the value of it, or what does it support? Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad you asked this, because there are two levels going on, and they're both super important. One is simply the working together and the multiplication of energy, as Paul Hawken talks about, with the hundreds of thousands of groups with the same message and out there doing what they're doing. That's the simple part. But what's underneath that is the emergence of the group consciousness. Now, Teilhard de Chardin, the great cosmologist, and Aurobindo also said, our evolution is a psychic evolution. We're actually growing in our consciousness, not to just be in our own personal field, but to understand a resonant field of we and groups that's a functional resonant field. So what's going on in all of these experiments, and they're dicey, but all these experiments with groups and networks and group leadership and group consciousness and group synergy, is people that are tapping into a group field, listening to that and discovering there's another level of reality in the reciprocity of all of those people in the room that has the ability to move what's going on. And that this is actually just the beginning of one of the most important emergent phenomena in our psychic evolution. Right now, we still all do this, still a lot of it. We don't always do that. We have some wonderful relationships, but even the best of the spiritual community is often having problems with disagreement and, you know, ideas and even conflicts of who's called to do what. Oh, I'm the download. I'm the download. I've got the download. You know, so this is just part of it. But where it's trying to go, and I spend a lot of time on this, and there are great groups out there that are doing this, because I've had this discussion with a number of other people. This is erupting everywhere. This experience of the group consciousness, the group synergy, the ability of the group to have a group skill set is emerging. And it's interesting. It's emerging in a very diverse way. I actually had a long discussion with someone about this. We did a video. It's emerging incrementally in some places. It's emerging in cataclysmic jumps in other groups. But that's what's happening. And again, my experience with this, we have to be so patient with how we get from whatever degrees are still doing this to what's able to do this. And you have to be so patient, because it's always a few steps forward and a few steps back. There's a great book out now called In Celebration of Lost Causes. And its point is that we may always fail, but we fail better. And that's an odd thing to say, but that's almost our experience in this group work. It's difficult and we'll tend to fail, make the same mistakes, but every time we get better. And I try, certainly now at my grand old age of 73, not to give up, you know, because it's so easy to think, oh no, everybody's just fighting again. People can't get along again. Nobody can agree, even in the spiritual community. But you just have to be so patient. But that's exciting, because I'll tell you this, when you feel that, and I'm sure you've had this experience, when you experience that in a group, you go, OMG, you know, oh my God, this is a whole nother level of the cognitive experience and the cognitive skill set. So last time I met with Ken Wilber, it was last summer. We used to get together a couple times a year. That's what we were talking about. Many of the things that he has pointed out theoretically and predicted, they're now happening in real groups in real time. It's not theoretical anymore, but I would say it's emergent enough that we really have to be patient with the, back to the metaphor from the chrysalis to the butterfly, we got to be really, really patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or what just comes to my mind when I listen to you, Kurt, is that what I experience often just personally, so I relate a lot to being patient, and I just experienced the more I'm really rooted in my heart and in my deeper truth, I just can see how the personality of Puriya is maybe acting in a way where another dimension of me just sees it and kind of is just almost being there like a mother, like a grown up for this child in me, which still operates in not so intelligent or appropriate behaviors, but we can find this place in us from a deeper level where we can just provide this ground, this patience, this compassion. And of course, it's also wonderful when we can apply that also to our partners, to our families, to in a bigger group. And I guess, as you mentioned, this is not something which just shifts and then it's done. It's something we need to do and do and do and apply, yeah, and apply and fail and make it better. And yeah, I'm so happy that you brought this to our attention, because I think it's really important, is being patient. Yeah.
Yeah. I just looking over my laptop as my plants in the window. Now, if I don't water them, they, you know, they would all die, and they don't even know maybe that they're dependent on me. But we have to do that every day with ourselves. Yeah. We have to be so patient with all the things that we are. We're the child, we're the adult, we're the scared person, we're the joyful person, we've got all these files from the past, you know, all the programs that are running, and even in awakened consciousness, where we talk about the transition from awakened consciousness to awakened behavior, and they're two very different things. And that's a growth process. So absolutely. But to be okay with that, you know, to be okay and also then be nurturing and growing, but to be okay that's part of the process. And the other thing, as you said, whatever happens, call it source, call it whatever we call it, we are given so many opportunities. The people that we meet, the people who come into our life, the projects that we do with people, the help we're able to give in tangible real time to real people in real time. These are all just amazing opportunities, and they never cease. And one of them now, I think so many people, even listening to this one, this Akashic overlap that we start to have with people, where we have dreams about them, about their past. We know things about them. You have a dream about them, and then they send you the photograph, and you have people that you experience this profound overlapping of your field with. And this, I think, is also a part of this psychic evolution of the, you know, what Aurobindo called the overmind, and, you know, what Teilhard called the Christosphere, the Buddhosphere, Krishnosphere, beyond noosphere, from consciousness to awakened consciousness. So it's interesting, even in Teilhard, that you've got everything he talked about in the phenomenon of man, but then everything he talked about in the divine milieu. And so much of science now is really fine with the things in the phenomenon of man. hard for them to go to the things in the divine milieu because they're more statements from theological language or theological worldview of these great potentials. I find it interesting that Teilhard actually divided those into two books. Maybe he knew that one was going to be quite digestible for science and the other was not going to be so easy for science, at least right away. But anyway, that potential is what we're talking about, that we would all be mini Ramana Maharshis.
What a lovely way to end with our beloved saint, Indian saint.
Yeah, can you imagine a world full of Ramana Maharshis? Wow. I'd take that world. He apologizes to bothering the bees or apologizes. You know all the stories.
I mean, shall we just end with this or is there anything else you want to share?
No, that's all good. I don't know what your time frame is.
Yeah, no.
This is such an incredible landscape. One could go on and on and on, yeah. But as long as people found it interesting and inspiring, inspiring, that's why we're here. So,
So Kurt, I'm so happy that you gave a yes to my invitation, that you took this time because you are active in so many fields. So I feel really honored to have you in this, in this gathering, in this great gathering for the Conscious Evolution Summit. And I send you my love and my appreciation for what you are doing. And maybe we will have another opportunity to meet either on via internet or one day personal. So I thank you so much, Kurt.
No, you're welcome. And right back at you, because the great surprise, which is always not a surprise and fulfilling, meet someone like you who I hadn't met before and we have this discussion and it just happens easy and we agree on everything. So just that helps us understand that globally, this is alive and well, even in people that up until now, I had never met you. And the degree of maturity and acumen in people never ceases to surprise me. Everybody I meet, you just get blown away by the level of maturity, acumen, and commitment that's in all of these people. So right back to you and to the summit and everything you're doing, I hope it's a big success and that people find it inspiring.
Thank you so much, Kurt. All the best to you.
Absolutely. All right. You can turn this off.
And thank you to all listeners, viewers, that you took the time to participate in our conversation. And maybe you also have this experience to feel quite close to us, even though you haven't maybe seen me before or Kurt before. And just let this in, this experience that how deeply we can be with each other and be connected with people we haven't met physically before. So in this sense, I wish you a good time and inspiration for the other interviews you might watch. Thank you.